Also, just checking that to ensure you're in the right room. So we're going to be listening to Andrew Herron. He's speaking about the truth about death and suffering. Is euthanasia a solution? So if you're not wanting to listen to that topic, I suggest you head off. Okay, so let's keep to time, and let me introduce Andrew. So as he comes to the platform, it's worthwhile just a little bit of getting to know Andrew. So Andrew, can you tell us, I suppose, I don't know, what your life situation, where you're up to now, what you do?
Probably the first thing to tell you is I'm technologically challenged. I'm an aged care chaplain with Anglicare, and we tend to not use technology very much in Anglicare, at least in speaking terms. So this thing is filling me with fear and dread. So if I turn this off by mistake, I apologise now. I'm married to one wife, Bronwyn. Bronwyn is a palliative care nurse, and in some ways she's much better qualified to speak about this topic than I am. We live in Kellyville. We have no children, but my mother does live with us. And she also informed me that she's more qualified to speak on this topic than I am because she's older.
Well, I reckon that's a great introduction, but how about I pray, and then we'll Andrew can keep talking to us. Dear Lord, we praise you because you are God over all things, over the young and the old. We thank you that your gospel is therefore relevant to for us all. Please guide us as we listen and guide Andrew as he speaks that we may understand your truth and your truth may shape our lives. Amen.
Amen. Richard, I'll just give you that one.
Well, first of all, I want to thank the organisers for inviting me to speak today. Thanks, Richard, for that gracious introduction. I actually didn't know about this conference until I was asked to speak about it, which shows my limitations. It also shows a little bit about where I'm in my ministry, because you are by far the youngest group of people I have spoken to this year. Yeah. So if you're 70 and sitting there, in my world, you are a young person. Of course, if you are 90, you're the age I'm used to speaking with. Euthanasia, death, suffering, they're difficult topics. They're difficult topics about which much is written. And I'm not intending to revisit at great length all the ethical arguments about euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, voluntary euthanasia, withdrawal of treatment, all those big things which were in the news. I'm not an ethicist. I'm a practical or a pastoral theologian. What that means is when someone asks me a theological question, I say I'm a pastor and refer them to somebody else. When they ask me a pastoral question, I say I'm a theologian and refer them to someone else. It's the ultimate cop-out. But what I will refer you to is the Social Issues Committee of the Anglican Diocese of Sydney. It's on their website, Sydney Anglicans, the drop-down menu there, Social Issues, and they have two briefings. Briefings number 57 and briefing number 87, which deal with this topic at an ethical level much better than I could ever hope to. But it is a difficult issue. And it's difficult for several reasons. Firstly, it's a highly emotive issue. We are dealing with death and suffering and a person's right to choose. But it's also something which impacts us all. I said recently in a sermon that there's only two universal experiences, and it's not death and taxes. My accountant's friends assure me that taxes are optional if you are clever enough. No, the two universal experiences are birth and death. Everyone but two people were born and everyone but two people have died and will die, barring the return of the Lord Jesus Christ in their lifetime. Now, no prizes for guessing it's Adam and Eve who weren't born. Those of you can work out who the two who didn't die were, brownie points for you. It's emotive. It's complex. It's complex medically. I work with a lot of medical people. And when you raise the issue of euthanasia, they want to talk about Game of Thrones or the football or almost anything else because it's a complex, practical issue in their world. It's complex ethically. If it was simple, we wouldn't be having front page spreads on the Sydney Morning Herald this morning, I'm informed, about this issue. And I want to add, it's complicated theologically. Some of the answers are very simple, but it's how we apply those answers which is where the complications arise. And there's a third reason this issue is difficult. And I refer you to the Sydney Morning Herald on the 26th of August, which was last week, where the headline was, "Most Australians are rubbish at dying." And I took great comfort from this because I'm English. And then I read the next line which said, "Don't be afraid, so does the rest of the Western world." Of course, I'm English when Australia loses the rugby, and I'm Australian when Australia wins the rugby. I am very English at the moment. What I want to think about today, just for a few minutes, is how we respond to the calls for euthanasia in the face of death and suffering with the truth. So we're speaking in truth categories today, and that's important. We're not necessarily dealing with experience categories. All of us here, I suspect, will have known of someone who has died and perhaps died badly. And that informs our thinking and our feelings and our beliefs. But we want to talk about truth categories. Secondly, we want to speak about the truth in love. That is, we want to speak the truth about euthanasia and death and suffering in a way which seeks to care for people. One of my great pains is to see how people speak the truth about this matter in an unloving way. We want to care for people rather than just win the argument. And so we have to be generous listeners. And again, we are not always good at listening. Listening to a person's personal pain, listening to their story, we want to jump to our answers. But to be loving and caring is to be generous in our listening. And from that, to recognise that people will hold different views for a whole variety of reasons. And some of those reasons may not be reasonable. We've been told this morning we live in a postmodern, post-rational, post-scientific world. And we see the echoes of that all around, which means truth has become variable, up for negotiation, and into that space of suffering and death and euthanasia, variability of truth makes things difficult. But because I do like definitions, even though they can be boring, I'm going to give you just a few. And I've taken these definitions from a social issues paper, which took them from an AMA report, which took them from a UK House of Lords Ethics Committee report, which is a polite way of saying I found them on the internet. It's also a polite way of saying that they're not mine. But I chose these definitions because they're neutral. I could have gone to a great theologian and got some definitions on these, one of the great ethicists. I work with an ethicist. He's my boss, Andrew Ford. He's very helpful to me in preparing this talk. But because he's a Christian ethicist, he, like me, comes with a Christian bias. I could have gone to Dignitas or the Voluntary Euthanasia Society and gone for their definitions, but they have a bias. Hopefully the House of Lords in the UK is somewhat more neutral. This is how they define euthanasia: a deliberate intervention undertaken with the express intention of ending a life to relieve intractable suffering. A couple of things are important there. It's a deliberate intervention. That is, it's premeditated. It has one intention. That is, ending a person's life. And the motivation is to relieve intractable suffering. That word intractable and similar words are tending to fall off our definitions of euthanasia. as we tend to want to have a more open definition of the nature of suffering. Related to euthanasia is assisted suicide. This is the term we use when a competent patient has formed a desire to end his or her life but requires help to perform the act, perhaps because of a physical disability. When the help requested is given by a doctor, and not all assisted suicide has help from a doctor, but when the help requested is given by a doctor, the act is called physician-assisted suicide. Now, for the purposes of today, I'm going to lump those two together because it's easier. There are subtle differences, but in terms of our response, I think that we can group them together. This is different from two other ideas. And the other side of the debate often wants to conflate these two different groups. The first is withdrawal of futile or burdensome treatment. When a patient is in a terminal stage of illness, a time may come when treatments aimed at cure are either no longer work, that is, they are futile, or the burden of their side effects, such as nausea or vomiting, may be so overwhelming that they cancel out the benefit of the treatment. At this stage, the treatment may not be prolonging life so much as prolonging the process of dying. At this time, a decision may be made to stop or decide not to start such a treatment. This is the key point. It is not euthanasia because the intention is not to kill the patient. The intent is the key point there. Symptom control. Sometimes in the terminal stages of a disease, the distressing nature of a patient's symptoms may require careful sedation of the patient. Once again, this will be done carefully in consultation with the patient, and the sedation may be lightened periodically to allow the patient to communicate. Again, it is not euthanasia because the intention is not to kill the patient but to alleviate their distressing symptoms. Euthanasia, physician-assisted suicide, the intent is to end the person's life. Withdrawing treatment, sedation, and there are other treatments as well, may have the effect of shortening a person's life, but that is not the intent. The intent is different. Now, it's easy to state that here in, I was going to say lecture theatre, but I think it's a theatre, isn't it? Wherever we are. It's easy to state that here. On the ground, it's much harder. Because the grey areas, mixed motives come in. But let us ask the question, why do people want to end their life or to end somebody else's life of a person they love and care for? It seems like a strange dichotomy. I love this person, so I want to kill them. That's a stark way of putting it. I've done it for effect. But why do we do that? Two main reasons. The first, to relieve suffering. Now, suffering in terminal illness is much more than physical pain. There's a lot of psychological aspects. There's the aspect of indignity. I work in aged care. I have a friend who is a resident, who has given me permission to share this, who is dying. And he has to be helped to the toilet and helped to toilet by two people. Not being dignified. But he's dying and he needs that help. There is issues of isolation and abandonment. So often when people are dying, we put them into hospital where they're surrounded by strangers, away from their family, away from their friends, away from their pets and their pictures and their toys and their own bed, and we leave them there. And we go and visit now and again, but they're left there 23 hours a day isolated. Suffering comes from those feelings of being a burden. They have to come all that way from Castle Hill to Westmead to see me. There's an hour there, there's an hour back. You know Sydney traffic. Loss of meaning. What's the point? I'm just lying here in pain, having someone to take me to the toilet, having someone give me medication, having someone feed me. What's the point? Why go on? Loss of hope. But there is the physical side of suffering as well in dying. And let's not for a moment minimise the impact of pain. And with constant pain comes fatigue, and often nausea and vomiting, loss of appetite. This is a men's conference and it's a big one. Loss of libido. Especially in younger men who are dying. Changes in physical appearance. The most confronting thing I have seen in my ministry is a man who is dying of cancer and the cancer had eaten away his face. No eyes, no nose, no mouth, no tongue. He could only hear. And it's really hard to look at him, apart from the physical side of that, because so much of our identity is tied up in our face. Suffering is the first reason advanced. The second, perhaps a little bit more postmodern, is the individual's right to choose how they would live. We live in a hyper-individualized age. Everyone is I, and everyone has the right to choose how they would live. And that right to choose is something we hold dearly. How dearly do we hold it? I was coming here this morning, the speed limit said 80, and I looked down and I had chosen to do 90. I do hope the police don't get hold of this recording. We choose all the time, and we have a right to choose, and we're going to hold on to that. And implicit in those rights to choose is the right to make the choice to end my life. Now, stepping back, thinking about those two things, relieving suffering, promoting choice, they're good things. As Christians, we don't want people to suffer. We don't want them to be a pain, psychological or otherwise. We don't want them to experience nausea and vomiting every waking moment. We want to ease that burden of suffering. We want to promote a person's right to choose. After all, free will is a God-given gift. It makes us human. Are the people who advocate euthanasia not onto something? Why am I against euthanasia? And I phrase that very deliberately because this is now a personal reflection as much as it is presenting what I believe to be the truth. The call for a person's right to choose ignores one very important thing. None of us is truly independent. Last night I enjoyed a lovely dinner which involved steak. And trust me, if it was down to me to butcher my own animal, I'd have to be a vegetarian. It gets worse because I have two black thumbs. If you have a lantana problem, I'm your solution. I can't garden a bit. I am totally brilliant at killing everything that should be green. So I'd be a starving vegetarian. I rely on the butcher, the greengrocer, the farmer, the market gardener just for my food, and I'm guessing most of you are the same. I'm not very good at being sick. I require my wife, my mother, and my doctor to care for me. And I'll be quite honest, I really like Anglicare. They pay me a wage which facilitates all of that. I'm not independent and neither are you. We are interdependent. We exist in a matrix of relationships. And the decision to end a life doesn't just affect the person whose life is ended. It affects everyone around them. A doctor friend of mine is scared by the idea of physician-assisted suicide because they may be called on to administer that lethal medication. And despite all the protestations about safeguards and freedom of choice and conscience, they are worried about it. It's affecting them now. The second reason I'm against it, it has to do with the nature of people. We are really good at one thing, sinning. We are brilliant at sinning. And all our motives and all our actions, no matter how altruistic we may think they are tainted by sin. And can any of us really be assured that over time, selfish reasons, such as greed, wanting to escape the burden of caring for someone, being tired and frustrated by their illness, will not get intermingled with a desire to see them end their suffering? Can any of us honestly say that we are truly, totally and absolutely selfless in our motivations? And alongside that is this. Care of the dying is expensive. The last year of your life, your healthcare burden, no matter how old you are, will be far more than the previous 10 years of your life on average. And it doesn't matter what age that is. Caring for the dying is expensive. And if we legalise euthanasia and physician-assisted suicide, how long will it be when the economic argument that care of the dying is more expensive than euthanizing someone makes the idea of caring become the immoral choice because it's expensive? Related to that is the person's own sense. I'm a burden. I could cease being a burden by simply ending my life. I don't want to, but it's better for my family. There are many burdens in this life. Those of you who are parents will know the biggest burden are called children. Babies are the most powerless, helpless beings in the world. They do nothing and they command all the attention. Now, I know this for a fact because one of the ladies I work with has had a baby and she brought the baby into work and I was totally powerless to get anybody to do anything. Yet we don't consider care of children a burden. Why should we consider care of parents? Because most people are somebody's parents, whether in reality or, as in my case, figuratively. Why should care of the elderly, the sick, the dying, the helpless be any less important? There's a final theological point. And I use this point cautiously because you can never argue this point with somebody who's not a Christian. Someone who has a non-Christian worldview is not going to hear this argument. But to we who are Christians, I'll give it to you. Death is not the end. All will face judgment. We confess that in the creeds, it's written in Hebrews. You can't discuss the idea of God's judgment with a non-Christian. They have no idea of God. How can they have an idea of God's judgment? But to we who are Christians, we recognise the truth and inevitability of God's judgment. Genesis 9 is one of my favourite chapters in the Bible. It's where God gives us animals to eat. I'd make a terrible vegetarian. But in that same chapter, God talks about how he will not hold anyone guiltless who takes a life in vain. Not because of the marvellous things they can do, but for one simple fact, every human being is in the image of God. How can we deprive someone of life who is created in God's image? in case you're following on the outline, I went to the part headed Dying Well and Living Well, the place of hope in suffering. And I've got, I've got some time. I started by quoting the Sydney Morning Herald. Most Australians are rubbish at dying. Trust me, we are. Mostly. Some people are very good at it. But the reason this article says that we are so rubbish at dying, along with the rest of the Western world, is we have medicalised dying. Behind this, I suspect, is this following thought. If we can't defeat death, we can cage it. We can control it. We can't overturn death, and so we're going to have death on our terms. What we are looking for in society is a controlled, predictable, pre-planned, painless, ordered, and above all quick, that is, suffering-free death. But when was life like that? Life is messy. Life is chaotic. We make our plans and they don't come to fruition. Life is full of pain and suffering. And I don't know about you, but the older I get, the less control I seem to have over my life. And I don't have teenagers. Karen Hitchcock, in the Quarterly Essay last year now, wrote an essay called Dear Life. And that idea of Australians want that pre-planned clinical caesarean section death is something she rails against. And I think she's onto a point there. The kind of death we want today is clinical. But that is very different to only a few centuries ago. Prior to the advent of modern medicine, the worst death possible was a quick death. The worst death possible was a quick death. A quick death was a terrible thing. Why? If you had a quick death, you had no time to get your affairs in order. You had no time to ensure that you died on good terms with those around you. You had no time to prepare for those who depended upon you. You had no time to make peace with God. The change that has happened as death has become about me rather than about you. Centuries ago, we didn't want a quick death so we could ensure the other people in our world were going to be okay when we're gone. But now we want a quick death because we're not okay with the world we're in. I really think that what we have done as a society is we've abandoned the hope we have in God and placed our hope in medicine and science. And that's the modern world. And when medicine and science have failed us, we've turned to one thing we have left, ourselves, and the right to choose our life. We recognize that medicine can't end suffering in this life, and so we rather would choose to end the suffering of this life. But let us look at this theologically for a few moments. Hope is not the absence of suffering. Hope is finding peace in suffering. Suffering, we know, is the product of evil. And when sin entered the world, suffering came with it. Hope is not found in a pill or a potion or a procedure. Hope is found in the work of God, who became one of us and suffered as one of us. If we want to oppose euthanasia, we have to have something that's going to offer the hope that euthanasia offers. Something which says to the person, you are important. Something which recognizes the reality of suffering, the pain of suffering, psychological, physical, social, and spiritual. And says, in your suffering, you can find peace. It's that thing. As I said, I work a lot with older people, very elderly, frail elderly, with all the comorbidities, to use a medical term, of aging, dementia, depression, dislocation, disease. And I've seen some wonderful people age graciously and die in tremendous pain and die well. Because their focus wasn't on ending their suffering, but because of the hope that they have in Jesus Christ and the love they are surrounded with, the suffering can be dealt with. The pain can be endured. Now, at this point, it would be great to say, it's really simple, guys. All you have to do is get out there, tell people about Jesus, put their hope in him, and all will be well. It's not that easy. Sorry. And if you think that's what I'm telling you, please listen to me right now very carefully. That is not what I'm telling you. Yes, we have to do that. But we also have to recognize there's more to it than that. Our own response to God and how we see God and how our faith in God plays out in our lives will determine how we respond to those who suffer. Interesting, important fact, and this is not from a religious observer in any way, shape or form, but from a medical practitioner. Most people who ask for euthanasia do so not because of pain, but because of despair and loneliness. Not because of pain, but because of despair, loneliness, the fear of dying alone and without hope. Our response has to be to meet the despair, the loneliness, the fear, and the lack of hope head on. And this involves the most dangerous four-letter word in the English language, time. If we want to confront euthanasia with a realistic alternative, we have to invest time and place a dying person at the centre of their care. Most of the people I work with have dementia. If you're in residential care, between 40 and 70% of the people you live with will have dementia. People who have dementia are often abandoned. Sounds terrible, but it's true. Not fully abandoned, but mostly abandoned. And when you're abandoned, even if you're not cognitively fully functional, you succumb to despair and loneliness. And the only antidote to those is people spending time with you, caring for you. People fear dying alone, not dying. And the only attitude we can use to combat that is to spend time with people, caring for them. And that fear of dying alone is the burden of hopelessness. At the end, by myself. The way ahead is twofold. The first, actually threefold, the first is the realm of the academic, to argue ethically and coherently against the principles of euthanasia. The second is medical, and here you have a part to play. My wife is a palliative care nurse. Palliative care is far more than simple pain relief with analgesia. It is holistic care by a skilled interdisciplinary team of health professionals which enables patients and families to acknowledge and attend to the distress within themselves and their relationships at the time of death. It offers unique opportunities for psychosocial spiritual growth. You can tell it's written by a doctor. And allows for healing even without a cure. We have a part to play there. We need to encourage our politicians, our doctors, the interest groups we are part of to push palliative care. But also, and this is where the church and us as individuals, we need to value people for who they are. They're not a burden. They are in the image of God. We need to be willing to care for them because they bear the image of God. We need to be involved personally in the loving, kind, generous, warm presence of care. So that when it all seems hopeless, they know the love of God because they know the love of God through us. Are there any questions? And please don't be boring and don't ask any. Yes, sir. They're not my definitions, they're the House of Lords definitions. Yep.
Where would withdrawal of nourishment fit?
Withdrawal of burdensome treatment. Okay. It's a complicated area. I said it was ethically complicated. Withdrawal of nourishment is an interesting thing. People lose their appetite as they die. It's just one of those things. And you can keep force feeding someone. You can sedate them and put an NG tube in and you can keep them alive for a long period of time, but that's the point, isn't it? You're keeping them alive. You're only delaying the dying process. A person who wishes to stop eating to allow the disease burden to take its course. And trust me, you think about nutrition. I'm a fairly, shall we say, traditionally built gentleman. If I stopped eating today, I'd be around for quite a while. But when you're dying, think about what else you're doing. The short answer is physically not a lot. And so the reserves you have generally will sustain you much longer than if you weighed the same, had the same BMI and body fat, and were living in the sedentary life that I lead. So we generally, even when we withdraw nutrition, even hydration, that's not what kills people. What kills them is the disease burden. Now, it's complicated because there are always exceptions to that rule. And that's where intent's important. The intent is to decrease the burden of suffering because if you've ever been sick and been made to eat, you know it's not very pleasant. Imagine how much worse it is when you're dying and people want to keep feeding you. Of course, one of my favourite stories, and I love stories, is we had a gentleman who was not very well. He was dying, and he lost his appetite, except for one thing. The only thing he wanted to eat was ice cream. He got ice cream for breakfast, lunch, morning tea, afternoon tea, and dinner. And with dinner, he had it with jelly. That's the care we're talking about. It's not simple, not rocket science. He loved his ice cream. Chocolate, vanilla, strawberry. He didn't like the bubblegum flavour. It was bright green. I couldn't eat it. Does that answer the question, sir? Yep. At the back.
Is God in
God really enchained them in the process of death? Is divine intervention so far away? I believe in the miraculous. If God doesn't want you to die, you're not going to die. Everything else withstanding, God doesn't want you to die, you're not going to die. So God is enshrined in the process of death because I have a high view of the sovereignty of God. God is enshrined in the processes of life from conception to death. God is sovereign. And so God is sovereign over death and he's sovereign over our dying. Does that mean God can stop you dying? Yes. Does it mean God will stop you dying? That's a question you have to ask God, not me. And I'm not being facetious there. What God can do and what God does do is God's business, not mine. But I believe in a loving, gracious, caring God who loves his people. And we see that most clearly in Jesus Christ, who is God incarnate, sent to die for us, to suffer for us. And so, yeah, I believe the God who suffers for us is involved in our dying process as well. All sorts of ways we can never understand. Is that a question over this side? What about, passive euthanasia. Oh, yes. Yeah. The question is, what about passive euthanasia? It's one of those lovely phrases that euthanasia loves to throw around. Because what they want to do is confuse the idea of euthanasia and withdrawal of futile or burdensome treatment. Euthanasia is a deliberate intervention undertaken with the express intention of ending a life to relieve intractable suffering. That intervention could be a shot in the arm with 10 cc's of nembutamol. That will end your life. Or it could be, we are going to stop doing this, not to allow the disease burden to take control, but to kill you. The intent is the important point. If the intent is to end life, it's euthanasia. Ignore the passive-active definition, it's euthanasia. If the intent is not to end life, it is not euthanasia. Intent is so important. Because often the action can be very similar. And the outcome will be the same. The person stops breathing. But what is the intent? Yeah, happy with that? You want to come back at me? No, okay, cool. Yeah, you can ask as many questions as you like. We're going to afternoon, so we've got heaps of time. Sorry. Yep. Oh, one more question. I thought you were going to ask one, Roger. We've got one more question. Yes, sir. Yep. Okay. That's a good point. My first comment would be, please ask my wife. Because, the question was, how do I reconcile advanced care planning and euthanasia? Advanced care planning, advanced care directives are a medical form you fill in with your GP, and I'll say this right now in case my wife does watch this video, please have one. What that allows you to do is to direct your treatment. If you are not able to answer for yourself. That's the key point. If you are not able. So imagine for a second that I slipped and fell off this podium, cracked my C3 vertebrae, and I was kept alive in an iron lung. But because someone here is a medical person, they managed to give me CPR while we waited for the medicos to arrive. So I suffered known brain damage. If I had an advanced care directive in place, and I was able to answer for myself, all my advanced care directive is good for is making it to a paper airplane. But if I'm not able to answer for myself, it will set out the course of treatment that I desire. But it's treatment. It's not euthanasia. So I can say, keep me hydrated. Keep me hydrated and ward off any secondary infections. I can say, don't mechanically ventilate me. Now, if you don't mechanically ventilate me, I will die. C3 vertebrae fracture, I'm toast. What's killed me? Broken neck. What you're not doing is drawing out the dying process. But I can also elect to be mechanically ventilated in the hope that in the future medical science will be able to do something. All an acanthic corrective does is give you control over your treatment when you're not able to answer for yourself. It does not allow you under current law to say, kill me. Again, intent is the important thing. Really clear on that, intention is so important. Just follow up? Excellent. Friends, thank you for your time. It has been a great pleasure. When you come to retirement living, please choose Anglicare. We're your preferred supplier. We are part of the Anglican Church. You should sign up now. Thank you. Thank you, friends.